If I can have your attention, we'll go ahead and get started with our program this morning. I want to welcome all of you to another meeting of the First Friday Breakfast Club, an association of gay and bisexual men, and the largest private breakfast club in the state of Iowa, and we have been that now for 21 years. We have a number of things we want to do as preliminary so that we then can get to our special speaker this morning. Our tradition is to provide an opportunity for those who are here for the first time to introduce themselves or to be introduced by their host. It's not a requirement, but if there are those who are here for the first time and want that introduction, now would be the time. Brian?
Good morning. This is Glenn Turner. He's recently moved here from San Francisco and lives in Hackensack.
Welcome. Others?
This would actually be Turk Pearson. He's actually part of our Iowa Leather team. And this would be his first visit.
Welcome.
Ben Tucker, I moved here from Northeast Iowa back in September.
Welcome. Others? Those of you who are regulars, please look around the room, and if you see an unfamiliar face, make sure that they feel welcome, and we'll continue to participate in First Friday Breakfast Club. I want to thank Scott Kupnio, my partner, for helping coordinate our book exchange. If you want to borrow a book, they're back there on the piano, and you're welcome to do that. There's no checkout system. Keep them as long as you like. If you have books you don't want to keep on your shelf, you can bring them, and we'll include them in our book exchange. excuse me. I invite you to check out our website, ffbciowa.org. It is constantly being updated, including audio of our speakers. So if you miss a meeting and want to hear the speaker, or you want to hear the speaker again, you can go on our website and click on our speakers and get to hear them in audio. If you have people in mind that might be interested in our club, there is a sheet at the registration desk. You can get us the name and some contact information, and we will be in touch with them to invite them to participate. The next item that we need to get handled is our annual meeting. This is our 20th annual meeting this year. So for those of you who are members, if you will notice, there is an agenda on your table. If you will take a look at that, and I will, as president of FFBC, I will call our meeting to order. Our nominating committee has come up with four candidates to be elected to our board of directors for three-year terms. Three of them are incumbents, and Jordan Duesenberg is included in the slate, and he is not an incumbent. So we have these four to be placed in nomination. I'm the chair of the nominating committee, and so those are in nomination. Are there any nominations from the floor? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to elect the slate that has been nominated by the nominating committee.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Abstentions, everybody that didn't say anything. Perfect. That is that carries, and those four people are elected. next, just a brief president's report. We came into existence in 1996, January of 1996, and we have been going strong ever since then. We are able to put together scholarships for high school students in Iowa that have done courageous things to educate about LGBT issues and to reduce homophobia in our state. And we have given away in the neighborhood of $250,000 in scholarships in that period of time. And those people have gone on to college, and they've gone on to continuing to do brave things for our community. But the beauty of the program, the power of the program, is not so much in the money that we give them, the recognition that we give them. All of those things are good, of course. The beauty of the program is that it buys us a ticket to their high school graduation, where one of our members goes and presents the scholarship award at their high school graduation, oftentimes in front of an audience that thinks they've never actually seen a real live gay person before. And when our person goes out there and makes the presentation, it has generated anecdotes that just warm your heart. Standing ovations occasionally, that kind of thing, when we go out there and recognize a member of their community. I think it has made a difference. I think it has been a culture changer for us to be able to do those scholarships. So that is one of the things that we are doing. In addition, we have been having these fundraising efforts every year to come up with the money to give these scholarships. I think we gave 9 last year, if I remember correctly. Does that sound right? And we are already now beginning our efforts to go forward with our fundraising this year. And we have already received over $3,000 in contributions toward our scholarship program. We're going to be having a recognition reception at Scott's in my home on the first Friday of next month to thank people who are donors to our Breakfast Club scholarship program. And the scholarships are $3,000 apiece. And another thing I want to point out is that a number of us who are guilted into giving money to United Way at our work get the little form and fill it out with their donor direct program that allows the donor to select the agency that will receive their contribution. And United Way will take out, I don't know what it is, 10% or something like that, and then the remainder goes to the designated agency. We qualify for that designation. And we have a number of people who are members who give through the United Way to FFBC last year to the tune of $2,246. So it's good money. And I encourage you to consider using the Donor Direct program. With that, we have one resolution that we need to adopt. It is on your agenda, and the resolution is very straightforward. And I invite a motion to approve that agenda. And is there a second? Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. And that carries. And with that, and absent objection, our annual meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. Okay, next. I have a number of announcements that I want to bring to your attention. First, I'm going to call on Jason Van Wyk for comment. Jason.
Good morning, everybody. I'm with Catholic City Pride. And just wanted to let you guys know some upcoming events that we have. As you may know, this year marks the 40th anniversary of Catholic City Pride. And so we started some new initiatives. One of them is the Sunday Tea Dance. So we have one of those coming up this Sunday at the Republic. And then we've also started a book club. So we have a monthly book club. This month it's January 18th at Smoky Row. We'll be discussing The Dancer from the Dance. Even if you haven't read it, come join us, grab a cup of coffee. We've also, you probably noticed a little pamphlet. We've also started a speaker series this year. Right now we have 4 speakers. We're looking to add 2 more. And each month we'll have a new one. In January, it will be Chadwick Boyd, who's nationally recognized as a cooking and lifestyle expert. He's been on Today's Show, AGTV, and some others. We've also got Jonathan Lovitz, who is the Senior Vice President of the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce, and Michael LaRosa, who was the former producer of MSNBC's Chris Matthews Parkall. This year we're also kicking off the Pride Gala. This is the first year that we're doing that. This is a way for us to recognize companies and individuals who contribute to the Des Moines LGBT community. So I've got a little flyer here. Tickets are available on capitalcitypride.org. And last but not least, we have a nomination form. So if you would like to nominate a company one individual who contributes to our community. You can either email the nomination or it will be on our website next week.
Very good. Thank you very much. Next, when I went on to Medicare, I was getting my prescriptions done at Walgreens, as I always had before, and Medicare sends you a little summary every month or so telling you how things are going, what they've paid, what you've paid, what others have paid, whatever. And I actually read the form here recently, and it seemed very strange. It had some very peculiar things in there about me paying some out of pocket, and the plan didn't pay anything, and yet there was money that wasn't accounted for. Who was paying that? So I started looking into it a little bit, and I learned that Walgreens is not a Medicare-approved pharmacy. So I took my prescription list and went to an approved pharmacy. One of them's Hy-Vee on Fleur, for example. Hy-Vee pharmacies are approved. CVS is an approved, and I asked them to tell me what I would have to pay for each of these various medications if I were to get them from them instead of Walgreens. On one medication that I take, it would cost me at Hy-Vee $25 out of pocket. The same medication cost me $110 at Walgreens. Scott did a calculation, and I will be able to save between $500 and $600 a year on my medications if I go to Hy-Vee instead of Walgreens. Now, I'm not advising that that's what you should do. I'm not marketing for Hy-Vee or any other pharmacy, but I did learn that you need to shop your meds and check that out. So just be advised, Walgreens is not an approved Medicare provider at the present time, and it makes a difference. Next, our board meeting next Wednesday. It's going to be at Byron Huff's home. So if you're a member and you want to come to the board meeting, you're certainly welcome to do that. Touch base with Byron for directions. Our newsletter copy deadline, for those who either regularly contribute to the newsletter or would like to, will be January the 15th. That's a week from next Monday. So if you are interested in contributing to the newsletter, that's our copy deadline. Get the copy to me. We are going to be doing a mailing tomorrow in support of our fundraising efforts. That's also going to be at Byron Huff's home, 11 o'clock. If you're available and want to participate in stuffing those envelopes and putting on the labels and whatnot, Byron's ordering pizza. So if you want to do that, get directions from Byron and participate. I call your attention to the Prime Timers of Central Iowa. They have 9 more events planned just for this month. So if you want to get together more often with a group of really good people, that would be an opportunity for you, and check them out online. And then, with that, I will turn to Taylor Vanderpool to introduce our speaker this morning. I can't hear you.
Who is sponsoring this flyer we got about the public option?
Matt.
Our speaker.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Taylor Vanderkroll. I'm the assistant to Senator McCoy for the past 2.5 years. Just come up.
And you're very tall.
I'm very tall. I'm doing this for Matt later. I'm the assistant to Senator Matt McCoy. I've been an assistant for 2.5 years. You all know him probably more than I know him, and I know we have a time constraint, so I was going to roast him for a good 10 minutes, but because his presentation is longer than a half hour and we have 20 minutes, I'm going to pass it off to Matt.
Thanks, Taylor. Always appreciate not getting roasted. It's 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm just gonna cover a couple things because I think we're living in interesting times and what I would consider a fragile democracy right now. And I think that our challenges as we look at the future are going to be how to get the public tuned back into what's happening, because so many people feel just so completely exhausted by this administration and all the news that comes out of this administration on a daily basis. And so one of the things that we're learning as we do polling is that a lot of folks that typically would get engaged in news and, you know, really have a certain common facts that we all share are tuning into Netflix and Hulu and watching this instead of broadcast news in the evenings. And they're really not reading the paper like they used to, and they're numbed out about what's happening in Washington, and they're depressed about it. And so as a result, I think what we have is we have become is this kind of sensationalized news, and with that there's this anti-Trump crowd, which is Fox News, is pro-Trump, and then MSNBC is anti-Trump, and we have progressive policies not being discussed. And what we tend to do is discuss the latest tweet, the latest rant that we see coming out of the Trump administration. And essentially, I think Trump is a genius. I think he's keeping the cards in his pocket, like taking a knee at an NFL football game instead of talking about the Russian interference in the election. The tweet that he did on transgender ban in the military came out as a surprise to everybody, including the U.S. military. And just in general, anytime he feels like the Russian thing's getting too hot for him, he starts talking about Little Rocket Man. And so essentially what we've created in essence is something they call the Overton window. And it talks a lot about what the new normal is. And the new normal is essentially moving everything to the right to such an extent that even right positions that were considered far right positions don't seem as far right today. And Taylor, why don't you show us that video?
How does watching this clip make you feel?
The president gave a man girl his support.
I can't believe that's a real sentence. Okay, focus. Now compare that to how you feel watching this clip.
The plot to stop the investigations into Russia and the president is entering a new and dangerous phase and at risk throwing the country into a constitutional crisis.
Oh my god, I'm trapped in a nightmare. All right, last one. How do you feel watching this?
What the GOP's tax plan is actually about is taking money from the poorest Americans to give to the richest.
Same reaction? No? You feel numb, don't you? If you've been watching the news for the past 12 months, your reaction to that last clip was probably... There's a term for what you're experiencing. It's called the Overton window. It's a concept in political science that says there's this window of ideas the public is willing to accept. Everything inside the window is normal and expected. Everything outside the window is radical, ridiculous, or unthinkable. And the theory goes that if you want to move the window, if you want to change what people think of as acceptable, you shouldn't start here. You should start here. At the extreme, because forcing people to consider an unthinkable idea, even if they reject it, makes all less radical ideas seem more acceptable by comparison. It shifts the window in that direction. So if you want to make people more accepting of gay relationships, you should start by arguing for gay marriage. You'll lose at first, but you'll start to make things like domestic partnerships seem more plausible. Then, civil unions start to seem normal too. Pretty soon, what started off as an unthinkable idea seems very thinkable, even boring. The point of the Overton window is that people don't have to accept a ridiculous idea, they just have to get used to it. Have to hear it enough to start comparing other ideas to it. And that might be the scariest part of Trump's first year in office. Not how abnormal he is, but how normal he makes everything else look by comparison.
This is not normal.
This is not normal.
This is not normal.
This is not normal, but it keeps happening.
In just the past 6 months, we've had to talk about the president sympathizing with white supremacists, retweeting anti-Muslim propaganda from a hate group, calling a world leader short and fat while threatening nuclear war on Twitter. Carlos, don't be hyperbolic. I'm not. Any of these stories would have been unthinkable under Obama or even Bush. But now they're things we have to seriously talk about. That means getting used to a lot of new realities over here in Trump land. And that's shifted the Overton window in some really terrifying ways. Sounds so ominous.
The Overton window.
The most obvious is that we now just expect to be bullshitted. At the start of Trump's term, we were shocked at the White House lying about the size of Trump's inauguration crowd.
It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
no,
on day
don't
one.
Don't be so overly dramatic.
But now?
The president in no way has ever encouraged violence. I don't think it's appropriate to lie from the podium or any other place. I wouldn't say it was a lie. It's pretty...
accusations. Yeah, he's a liar.
Well, that gives you a little overview of what we're dealing with in terms of our democracy. So when I say our democracy is fragile, I also believe that our democracy is capable of handling anything that the Trump administration, short of nuclear war, that they could impose upon us. Because most of the things they're doing, we can reverse. But some of the things that are slipping through the cracks, yesterday, there was a front page New York Times story about opening up drilling off of the US coast. That got buried in the news yesterday because of Fire and Fury, the book that will come out today that shows just, you know, what a dysfunctional and chaotic White House we have currently. So, in Iowa, back home here in the heartland, we had a really rough session last year, and we're getting ready to start session next week on Monday. And so lock up your liquor, keep your teenage daughters under lock and key, and hold on to your wallets because the legislature's coming back to town. Last year they gutted Taylor, was that you? I think that was you. They gutted collective bargaining. They actually changed our work comp system in a major way to favor corporations as opposed to injured employees. When we have one of the best work comp systems in the country, and it was one of the lowest cost worker compensation systems, and we found that In terms of fraud, waste, and abuse, that the system only had about under 3% fraud, waste, and abuse. So people weren't cheating the system, but they went in and changed it in such a dramatic way that it really put workers at a disadvantage. As most of you know, they cut the funding for Planned Parenthood, and we've lost four clinics as a result of that. And we had just, you know, we had just celebrated having a 20-year decline in teen pregnancy. And so I think this is probably going to change as a result of this lack of funding for Planned Parenthood because so many teens were able to get their birth control and counseling through Planned Parenthood. And that will have other ramifications down the road in terms of unwanted children. And unplanned children. And then they preempted the minimum wage when in fact we have not had a minimum wage increase now going on, you know, well over a decade. So what's ahead? 2018, they're talking about sanctuary cities. You know, just to set the record straight, and I say this wherever we go, Iowa does not have any sanctuary cities. Sanctuary cities is a term that's been given to cities that allow for individuals to live in the city and in essence be undocumented. And so, you know, one thing we've said in the city of Des Moines and Polk County is that we're not going to enforce ISIS laws on the people that live in Polk County, and if in fact they break the law, we'll abide by any legal retainers or detainers by the ISIS organizations that ICE that asks us to detain people, but otherwise we're going to let people live their lives. They're talking about tax reform, and it's interesting that they're talking about tax reform when they're borrowing money from the rainy day fund and the emergency reserve accounts. They're still talking about imposing tax cuts for corporations and trying to, in essence, sweeten the pie for the corporate community here in Iowa when we can't even afford our basic some of our basic services. There's a religious exemption bill, and we talked a little bit about this. They call it religious liberty bill. It really is a is an effort to discriminate based upon whatever characteristics you don't like in the person that you've been asked to serve with public accommodations. Bathroom bills and transgender rights, rolling those back so that school districts don't have to establish separate accommodations for transgender students. And then they're talking about a complete rehaul of the IPER system and maybe moving away from a defined benefit system to a defined contribution system. And what do we have in Iowa? We have ongoing deficits in a growing economy. And one of the things that most people that have paid attention have noticed that the governor has gotten into the rainy day fund. Prior to leaving for China, he borrowed $131 million from the cash reserve fund, being the fiscal conservative he was, to pay for one-time ongoing expenses. That was after he cut $88.2 million from the budget last year. And Kim Reynolds, while we were out of town, transferred what appears to be illegally $13.8 million from the Economic Emergency Reserve Fund so that she didn't have to call the legislature into a special session. And as a result, what we found for next year, assuming that our growth rate stays even, that in essence we're going to have about $175 million in new revenue and about $275 million in built-in expenses. So we're going to have to find another $100 million. And that's if we achieve a 4% growth rate. And we've been running about a 2.7% growth rate. So what happens in that scenario is misguided budget priorities. And this is where I like to talk about some of the things that have happened. Well, without legislative approval, the governor and the Department of Economic Development have a slush fund to allow for these credits to be handed out to corporations. And right now they're running about $500 million annually. They handed Apple $150 million to build a data plant in Waukee. Apple currently sits on $290 billion in cash reserves. They spent $200 million building a fertilizer plant in Lee County, which supported one of the wealthiest families in Egypt. So these are some of the priorities. So all in all, we're spending $500 million a year. And somebody just told me that today they saw that Casey's was expanding in Ankeny and they needed an additional $35 million expansion. They're going to need a lot of state aid for that. So this is the new normal. And I think that one of the things that we have to address is what happens to Iowa when the economy stops growing at the rate that it currently is growing, and how we bring in enough new money to pay for our ongoing expenses. And when I talk about our ongoing expenses, I'm talking about things like schools, public education, our region system, our prison system, and our Medicaid system. So you can see kind of where we're headed. This gives you an idea of some of the refundable tax credits. These are research and development refundable tax credits. So regardless of whether an industry has a tax liability or not, they actually get a refund from the state government. And I just want you to see John Deere, Rockwell Collins, and DuPont representing, you know, roughly $250 million where they rated compared to maybe your University of Northern Iowa, Iowa State, or Iowa over the past 6 years. That's new money that's gone into the system for region institutions. So they've actually received a deficit. Community colleges received $18 million. But it just shows you where our priorities are as a state. Corporate refunds, $231 million versus what we're doing for community colleges and region institutions. And what we project the tax giveaways to be in terms of our school funding. For local schools, it's $40 million. For Des Moines, that's $59 per student per year, which is a half of a sophomore textbook for biology. And what gets cut in these tough budgets is K-12 education. DHS has been privatized, as most of you have read about. It's a complete disaster. It's costing the taxpayers more money. The Iowa prisons get understaffed, and we have outbreaks and violence in the institutions. And then our region institutions, as you can see, have been taking it in the shorts. And today on the front page of the Register, they're talking about tuition increases over the next 5 years at 7 to 11%. My son's at the University of Iowa. How do I prepare for the next 3 years that he'll be there with 7 to 11% increases, knowing that's going to happen? So in terms of what I want to accomplish in the upcoming session, I want to move forward with holding oversight hearings regarding the Department of Human Services. We have a new director of the Department of Human Services, Jerry Foxhoven. He's doing a wonderful job, but he needs increased caseworkers, additional funding. We need to take over the process of going out and inspecting the homes for prospective adoptive and foster care families. And we need to end the homeschooling option for foster and adoptive families that receive adoption subsidies so that we can provide a safety net through the school system to protect the kids like Natalie Finn and Malaya Knapp and Sabrina Ray, who were all supposedly homeschooled as they were abused and held hostage in their homes and tortured. That is what I would like to work on in the upcoming session. Obviously, politics are local. I think that one of the things that is happening in our state, if you saw the article in the Register, Where Are All the Kids? You know, the fact is we've seen a major transition in our state from rural to urban. 70% of our population now live in 10 counties in our state, and our urban areas are really without any kids today, and yet we're maintaining over 400 school districts in our state and 99 county seats. And so I think local governments are going to play a larger and larger role in how we move our state forward. And here in Polk County, we're expected to surpass 1 million people by 2040. And I think we need to be a leader in the capital city in innovation by passing ordinances and creating our own boundaries where we can have progressive communities regardless of what's happening around Iowa. And that starts with electing local elected officials that are engaged in moving a progressive agenda in cities like Polk County, in cities like Des Moines in Polk County as well. And those 10 largest counties can be a great a great place or incubator for progressive ideas. So again, the light at the end of the tunnel is what is shaping up to be a Democratic wave election in 2018. We've seen in our special elections in Iowa a 31-point shift to Democrats where they were voting for Trump, and now their 31-point shift to Democrats in District 3, which was a special election we had. In District 82, the same kind of shift. The same kind of shift in 89, and then in the Senate, a 32-point shift to Democrats in a very conservative Steve King, deep right area of our state. And obviously, we're all celebrating Alabama, what happened there, and the empowerment of the African American community to elect Senator Jones over Roy Moore, and then our first transgender elected official in Virginia, Danica Rowe. So the good news is we are in a state that has experienced a lot of challenges. We've gotten through most of them. We haven't had a farm crisis in Iowa. We haven't had really tough economic times in Iowa yet. Our budget priorities are out of whack. I think most of us agree that we're doing too much corporate welfare, and we've got to change that. We're having an amazing crop of candidates running for governor, and I think that we have intentions of filling every Democratic seat in the state at the legislative level, the House level, and the Senate level, so that everybody gets a race on the Republican side of the aisle and they don't get any free walks, because if you sense that a wave election is coming, this is in essence what you do to prepare for that wave, is to fill every seat and really get people out and get them involved in the election process. So that's what I wanted to cover with you about the upcoming session. I'd be happy to take any questions that you have about that or anything else that you want to talk about. Yes?
I know the new voter ID law is, that's a done deal. But after November, is it possible to see a lot of lawsuits being filed because people can't prove that they were disenfranchised? In Pouchy County, we have a situation of, we've always had two driver's license stations, one in Grinnell, which has 9,000 some people, and then one in the county seat, a county of 18,000. And now there's just one. And because of the budget in the state, they've taken away our funding to be able to have two, so we're down to one. So, which means everybody in Grinnell's now got to somehow get to Montezuma to get their ID.
Right. I think there will be, ACLU is watching that issue very closely, and they will be monitoring for disenfranchisement of any kind, and we will definitely be suing wherever we see it and wherever it occurs. I think that the impact of the Real ID Act actually and the voter ID reforms will actually have cutting consequences for both Republicans and Democrats, because I think it's that soccer mom that whips into a voter station without her purse that she forgot to pick up when she went to get the kids from soccer, that goes in to vote and can't vote because she doesn't have her ID with her. I think we're going to hear about those stories as well. So I think one of the things we've tried to do is we've tried to reach out to seniors to let them know they can get an ID at no charge to them through the Secretary of State's office, and tried to outline a process for them. And that's part of our driver outreach program. And for the first time, we have more registered Democrats, Republicans, and Independents in the state than we've ever had. We're at 1.9.3 million Iowans, which is a pretty amazing number. We've never been that high. So I think it's setting up for a wave election. But we'll be monitoring polls very closely as a state Democratic Party.
Man, I think the Republicans are getting ready to propose a bill to fund water quality that's rather puny compared to funding the Natural Resources Trust.
Right.
What are the odds that will happen, and what are the odds that we'll get that trust finally funded with the increase in sales tax?
Yeah. Great question. So we have a proposal that Iowans have voted on twice called I Will. It's 0.375, and it's going to be long-term devoted to water quality, primarily focusing on the Raccoon River Basin, where 65% of the state's nitrates reside and flow into the Gulf. That bill has passed, you know, two popular votes, and all we need to do as a legislature is to fund it and start collecting the 0.375. That probably will not happen under this Republican regime. And what they propose doing is something that I think is really irresponsible, and that's to go in and raid the infrastructure budget for about $30 million a year and call it good and call it a water quality bill, when we all know that's completely inadequate and you can't bond for that money and it's not long-term funding. And to fix the water quality problem, we're probably looking at probably 2, 3, 4 decades of work and probably upwards to $1 billion to really get after clean water in Iowa. Yes, sir.
I'm trying to figure out if we actually are a country that is devolving into 5 political parties rather than 2, and this because of the alt-right, what I call maybe the normal right-wing Republicans, the left, and then the kind of ultra-left with the Sanders people, and then, of course, the largest party of all, which is the independents. Thanks. And I'm curious how that's playing out, especially with latest case of Citizens United and how the money is playing out in that regard.
Yeah. Well, I would tell you that we are less of a republic today than we were. I think we're becoming more of a country being run by the oligarchs, and the trend is, because of money and politics, that we'll see more of that instead of less of that. That decision by the Supreme Court, Citizens United, fundamentally changed our democracy, and if anything kills our democracy and destroys our republic, it will be Citizens United. It will be this unchecked, unfettered, dark money that's entering into political campaigns essentially to buy elected officials to the point where we see a Congress today that's in complete polarization and not moving anything forward. So I think your observations are interesting. I don't think that it's played out enough to know whether we're going to see a Green Party emerge, but I think it's highly possible. In this, there's a lot of built-in rules in our system that favor a two-party system, and that will probably keep that from happening. But for now, I think it's something we're going to all be watching.
Yes, ma'am. February 5th, we have the Iowa caucuses, off-year caucuses. And most people here in the room don't know what the most critical part of that caucus is, which is a motion that occurs at the beginning, whether or not to caucus for by gubernatorial candidate or by legislator, congressional candidate or some other purpose. Would you care to share your opinion about how that should proceed and then with everybody here, what the process is to getting to whichever breakout group, set of groups.
Sure, yeah. Sure. So basically what Max defined was the process that everybody has to make when they come together for the off-year caucuses and how they want to organize themselves. And so you can organize yourself by congressional candidates that you're supporting, or you can organize yourself by gubernatorial candidates that you're supporting. I personally think that organizing from the top of the ticket down is the way to go for gubernatorial candidates.
All right, and are you aware of the arcane rule for doing that?
Yes.
Okay, would you share that, please?
Well, essentially, it's trying to determine where people are.
Well, okay. What it is this, and we're holding at First Unitarian Church a caucus, pre-caucus forum, two weeks in advance of
the caucus on Monday, January 22nd at 7 to 8:30 p.m. First Unitarian Church, 1800 Bell. One of the things that will be asked of the Democratic executive director, both the Democratic and Republican executive directors for Polk County are going to be responding to questions. One question that will be asked is, what is the first order of business and how do you control it? And what actually occurs is that if you're going to be running your caucus, you're going to be chairing your caucus, you have total control as to whether or not the breakout will be by a gubernatorial candidate or by a congressional candidate. The rule is this: the first person to be recognized by the chair to then make that breakout proposal, and whose proposal gets, get this, 15% or more, either 15% of the total vote of those present, that is the way things will go. And it isn't such that there will be a second motion to vote on, there will only be one. And so if you're going to be chairing that caucus, or going, if you know the chair of that caucus, then you need to make a pact with that individual to be the first person recognized and make that motion. Thank you.
Thanks, Max.
Yes. The caucus can also choose not to divide up into congressional or governor.
Right.
Yes.
So right.
That's right.
By preferences. Right. Yes.
So in other words, we can throw away our Democratic thoughts and views and go with the Republican ideas of what to do. Because that's what they do all the time against everybody. They don't do them democratically about how things should be. So we're going to go for that now, too?
It's a party rule within the Democratic Party,
yeah,
that is created at the next convention or change.
Yeah. So you want to make sure that this gets this way so that we do things just like the Republicans do it, what you're saying.
No, well, actually what we're saying is we're just trying to do a little education for those that are going to the caucuses so that you know, one of the things that I hope people will do is to break out by gubernatorial candidates. But if they don't do that, I hope that they'll at least stay together as a group to take care of how we organize for the next election, because that's really the purpose of off your caucuses.
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, as I'm thinking about this and listening to it, given the way we select nominees for these offices, what's the point? They are not chosen by the caucuses as the, it's not like the political process where the delegates make difference as to who is ultimately the candidate. It's entirely the voters with the primary. It doesn't make a bit of difference what an individual caucus or even a state organization does in terms of who their delegates support.
Well, that isn't really accurate because you are, in essence, choosing nominees to run from those.
When I go to vote in the primary, I'm voting for the candidate.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with whoever the delegates were to the state party.
Right.
So actually, the delegate selection process, unlike the presidential one, where it controls ultimately the outcome of the convention,
right,
is irrelevant as to who the people support as a candidate.
That's true. I mean, it's true in the sense that a primary is still going to be an open primary, and we're still going to have a primary in June, regardless of what the delegate. I hear what you're saying on that.
35% they're going to have in the primary. There's
seven
or eight candidates, so if one of them doesn't get
that's right
35% at least, then it goes to the delegates.
That's right.
To the convention.
To the convention. So that's why it matters.
Which starts at your precinct caucus.
Yes.
Do you want to say something real quickly about David Young?
So I think David Young is extremely vulnerable. I think that David could be beat, and that we have a great field of candidates, and ultimately. Whoever comes out of that primary, I think is going to be a real opportunity for a pickup for us. I think the key with David Young is he's been a bag man for Chuck Grassley for a lot of years, which means he's gone out and collected the money for Chuck Grassley's campaigns as his chief of staff, and now he's a congressman. So. The key is having enough resources for whoever we run against him to expose his extreme right voting record, which has been anti-gay, anti-progress, supported a bad tax cut plan, has been silent on immigration issues. I think he's got a lot of problems as a candidate for Congress, and I think whoever comes out of the primary will have plenty of material to work with.
Well, if he's voting anti-gay, I say we expose him for the gay man that he is.
Well, I have no firsthand knowledge of that. I'm proud to say. Thank you.
If you wanted the first-hand knowledge on that, you could raise your
hand. Yeah, we would be very interested in talking with you after the program.
I have one question. Where are you going from here? You have been very visible in the public eye, yet you have so North Springs governor. Janet is the minority leader. Where do you see yourself going from this point?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm working through that issue right now, and I think that I'll be making some announcements about my intentions on whether I'm going to seek re-election, probably the end of January. There's other positions that I'm looking at right now that would maybe put me closer to local elected officials, and I'll be examining all those options over the next few weeks and causing a lot of grief for Taylor, and I'll get back with the decision, but look for a decision sometime around the end of January, 1st of February.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
You're familiar with our tradition,
yes,
to give a CD. I think you've actually spoken here before. You may already have this CD. You can re-gift it if you
want. Thank you.
If you want.
I will put it to work. Thank you.
Thank you, man. Thank you, Matt. Matt, as a member of our breakfast club, is a very important piece in the political process in which we are all involved, whether we like it or not, whether we vote or just sit on our hands at election time. And I think that Matt has fairly single-handedly moved that Overton window to make gay people perceived as more normal when he works at the state legislature and demonstrates that he's an overachiever and smarter than the average bear up there. And he's done some great work there, and whether you're there or elsewhere in a decision-making process, you do us proud and we appreciate it. Thank you, Matt. I'm hopeful that you will all continue to participate in FFBC. I'm hopeful that you'll be at our next meeting in February. Our speaker in February will be Carol Hunter, the executive editor for the Des Moines Register, as it continues to dwindle and shrink as it was delivered to our doorstep. It'll be interesting to hear from her. In March, our speaker is going to be Ann Seltzer, the CEO of Seltzer Group, a polling firm that is rather highly regarded, and we can find out about polling. In April, Sergeant Paul Parizak of the Des Moines Police Department is going to be our speaker. He is the usual spokesperson for the Des Moines Police Department. After whatever crime has been committed, they put a microphone in front of Paul's Parizak, so you will all be familiar with him, and we'll make sure he wears his uniform. Then, in May, our speaker is going to be Keith Snow. He's the CEO of a personal data mining firm, and he is going to be an eye-opening speaker. If you give him two, maybe three points of reference, he can tell you what dog food you buy. I mean, it's remarkable. You can really look forward to this. It's going to be eye-opening and might make you just a little nervous or paranoid. But paranoids even have real enemies, so it may be worthwhile. Then in June is going to be Brad Clark, the new executive director of the Gill Foundation. So we can look forward to that. He's an Iowan, so he's going to be coming home, as it were. He used to be a participant in the Breakfast Club when he was living here in Des Moines. And then in July, Secretary, former governor of Iowa, Tom Vilsack, is going to be our speaker in July. So we have those to look forward to. That's the first half of the year, and I've got some other things in mind for the remainder. Thank you for being here today. We'll see you in February.
Thank you.
Thank you.